there's a quote on your website that I found really interesting as well. The world's first sustainable mining company. I mean, what makes this a particularly good time, you would say? How has it changed from impossible to possible now? What's changed in the market?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there. And maybe just to start with, you know, we're building underwater robots to pick up battery metals. And that's really something that is needed to allow everyone to drive an electric vehicle. You know, we need actually more mining, not less, if we're going to move away from fossil fuels. Fundamentally, I think Elon Musk recently tweeted that batteries are the new oil. And I think he's completely correct about that. You know, what we want to do is substitute oil for batteries. But batteries are made up of metals, and these metals are finite, and we have to get them from somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, why do you think there has been, I guess, less attention given to this, and it's been overlooked? And I remember reading the Time magazine article that your CSO did, and, you know, most people are unaware of their metal footprint, but they're very aware of their carbon footprint and how much they're impacting in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, it's complexity, and we as humans are not great at dealing with complexities. You know, the simple message is you switch from a gas vehicle to an electric vehicle and the world is perfect.
Yes.
But the reality is that actually there's some consequences in how that electric vehicle was made, where did the metals come from, what was the ESG footprint, and then also how are you charging? Do you have solar in your house? Or are you using a coal power station to charge your EV? So this is an extra level of complexity that not many people really think about, but we think they really should, because we want to do this transition in the right way. We want people to move away from fossil fuels, but not at the expense of really hurting the planet or the environment or people in that transition.
Absolutely. And can you talk about how your technology works as well? Because I think it's very interesting. There's a video on your website that gives a bit of a demonstration as to how it would work in a perfect world. But why don't you explain it? Let's hear it from the
panel. Yeah, I mean, I think most people, probably a lot of your audience, are just not familiar with the resource that lies on the seabed. So, you know, what I'm holding up here to the camera is a polymetallic nodule. So this is the resource that we are attempting to pick up. And unlike land-based resources for nickel and cobalt and copper, those are typically below the surface, and you have to kind of dig and extract. The beauty of this resource is that it actually forms into these little golf ball size little rocks, and they just lie on the seabed in massive quantities. In fact, it's been estimated that there is more nickel and cobalt in these resources just lying on the seabed than we find on land. And so the plan is, how do we pick these up? Now, they are very deep and they're very remote. And the conventional wisdom that actually has been around since the 70s, so over 50 years, is to build dredging technology. And this is what all of our competition are doing. They're basically taking a very, very large collector machine, lowering it to the seabed floor where it has tracks a bit like a tank. And then it has effectively 8 or more hoovers on the vehicle where it actually squirts water into the top sediment where the nodules are lying and then sucks all of that water up a tube. And then it tries to remove some of the sediment and then sends it on a long riser tube where every mile or so there's an additional pump to the support vessel. And that is the conventional wisdom. There's maybe a dozen or so companies building that technology. It was first tested in the 70s. But we felt that there should be a better way. And the big problem with that approach is really the environmental destruction. It indiscriminately removes all of the life that's in front of the machine. So if there are some sponges, some corals, or other types of fauna, all of that will be destroyed. And there is a lot of biodiversity in the ocean, meaning every time we do science and we try to study what's down there, we find unique life forms. And so if you destroy all of it, that's really not good. And so we have designed or in the process of designing a fleet of autonomous underwater vehicles or AUVs. These are robots that will actually go to the seabed, hover, and then use computer vision and AI to selectively pick up the rocks, leaving behind the ones that contain life.
I guess, and again, I'm trying to think of it from the other, because again, you're based in San Jose, you're a Silicon Valley company. A lot of people are very optimistic about the tech coming out there, but a lot of people aren't as well. I mean, how are you going to convey that to the public that, you know, this is a new piece of technology? Like, I guess, why has it taken so long as well to create something smaller, more efficient?
Yeah, I mean, the seabed, although it's a resource that we've known about 100 years, some work started in the 70s, but it kind of stopped because there wasn't a clear legal framework. Who owns the seabed? Who can give you permission? How much are you allowed to remove? What are the rules around what you can do and what you cannot do? All of that was unclear in the 70s. But what happened was that there was a United Nations Convention on the High Sea that was ratified in the early 80s. And that started to define the rules about what is the territorial waters or the exclusive economic zone of a country, normally 200 nautical miles off the coast, and what is international water or high seas or areas beyond jurisdiction, national jurisdiction. And as part of that treaty, it also established the creation of an entity called the International Seabed Authority, or the ISA. That authority basically has the remit to regulate the mineral rights in international waters. And so that authority has been working on the mining regulations and has also issued what we call exploration permits. So these are a precursor that guarantees a certain location and allows you to do science and to understand what is the environment, what is the size of the resource, what are the costs involved in getting the resource, and what is the environmental baseline that's there. And so all of that has kind of happened, and we're at the point now where we're likely just a few years away from this production mining absolutely beginning to happen.
Could you talk about some of the building as well behind the prototype? I understand the prototype's being built right now, but are some of the rules and regulations that are being passed, are they conducive to a launch, or is that something that's neither here nor there?
So, you know, there are exploration permits that have been issued by the ISA. There is also some countries that have also issued exploration permits as well. But no production permits have been issued. And to be honest, are still a decent amount of science and environmental baseline has to be done before those will be granted. So we're still a few years out. For us, our focus is really on building our collector machine. And, you know, we are currently working on what we call the shallow water proof of concept. So this is a smaller scale vehicle than the full production. And it's a vehicle that this current version is designed for like 100 feet. Now, that will not work in the real locations because they are much deeper than that. But we will plant some rocks and pick them up ourselves. It's really to prove the technology. And, you know, we are hoping to demonstrate that early next year. And show that off working. And then after that, we're also working on the version 4, which is the full ocean depth proof of concept. And so that is a version that can go up to 4 miles deep, again, smaller in scale. And that is something that has the capability to go to the full ocean depths and pick up real nodules in the Pacific Ocean. And we would hope to demonstrate that next year.
Makes sense. That's something I'm really curious about as well. Like when it comes to hardware companies, when it comes to aerospace, the types of companies that you're building, when it comes to deep sea mining or just resources in general, the way that investors look at the product is very different. And I'm hoping you can speak to that because we sometimes hear like minimum viable product. You went through Y Combinator. Y Combinator talks often about an MVP, but it doesn't really seem like an MVP is possible sometimes with some of these like really ambitious projects.
So we did build an MVP, and that was directly as the feedback from YC. In fact, we changed our roadmap a little bit. And that was what we defined as the robotic arm and the vision system that ran in a test tank in our lab. And so the feedback that people gave us was that in the YC program of 3 months, you want to have built something, even though we're doing hardware, and it would not have been possible to build the shallow water vehicle in that time frame. It's just too much complexity. But we narrowed it down to something that was achievable, although challenging, and we were able to demonstrate a robotic arm and camera and lights and vision system and AI that selectively would pick up the rocks and run autonomously. And we just got that to work in the 3 month time period. And if people are interested, we actually have a video of it on our website where you can see it working.
Another question that I had, kind of relating to fundraising and pitching, you've founded companies before. If I'm remembering it correctly, MIPI Alliance was one that you started in the early 2000s. Is there anything that's changed in your opinion in terms of raising, in terms of the dynamics in, you know, the infamous Silicon Valley?
Yeah. So this is the third company that I've had the pleasure of actually founding. So MIPI or MIPI Alliance actually is a nonprofit that I did to help standardize interfaces. And I did that as kind of part of my day job working at Arm. But then in 2012, I founded a video compression company called NG Codec. So I think definitely having, you know, the MVP showing something is some of the advice that I think YC gave us that really helped. You know, one of the things they kind of teach startups that enter their program is it's a 3 month program, but for 2 of those months, don't really think about fundraising. Think about delivering on some metrics. What are you going to deliver that shows to investors that you are a team that can execute? And so for us, it was 3 things. It was that arm, robotic arm, that the engineering team led by Jason were really focused on. But we also were able to sign a partnership with a company called Boskalis. So Boskalis is a big 100-year-old Dutch dredging company that happens to be part of a group of companies that has a permit for seabed mining. And so getting that partnership signed and announced was a really important milestone. And the third was we were able to get letters of intent to actually buy battery metals. So we were able to get about $500 million worth. And so by doing those 3 things, it gave us momentum coming into demo day and fundraising. Because
No big deal. $500 million. That's a small number.
Fortunately, you know, batteries are used in massive amounts of quantities, and these metals are pretty valuable. So we're lucky that, like all mining businesses, we'll have no revenue, and then we should have billions in revenue as the mine starts to deliver.
Given that you've started 3 companies now, what has changed about your view on investing as well? Because I feel like some people, they might go for the highest bidder, they might raise too much money and be expected to scale too fast, and that can ultimately lead to their demise. If you have advice for a first-time founder raising, whether it be in your space or otherwise, what would you say to them? What's been the most telling for you?
Yeah, I mean, fundraising is never easy. You know, it's always hard. It's an emotional journey because the majority of people will say no.
Yes.
And you have to be prepared for that and not get discouraged. I think that's one thing I would say. Secondly, everything you need to do is to get that first term sheet. Once you have one term sheet, you probably can bring in others, and you potentially have the opportunity to negotiate and get the best partner for you with the best terms. But until you get that first term sheet, it's all a bit academic. And so, you know, I wouldn't focus on valuation at the early stage. I would focus more on people that you really want to work with. I mean, investors that join your cap table and maybe take a board seat, this is more intimate than getting married. It's almost impossible to get rid of an investor that you don't like. And so be pretty selective. And in our early days at Impossible Mining, we were fortunate to have a term sheet at the same valuation from a tier one, a large, big fund. And we debated. There were pros and cons on both sides, but ultimately it came down to the individuals and the reputations, and we went with the smaller team.
This was actually something I was speaking to a VC about not too long ago. They worked at Index. Everyone can find that episode if they want. But I asked her that. I said, hey, you know, if you raise from Sequoia, like, you're probably not going to get Alfred Lin on your board. But if you raise from a smaller team, you might not get that branding, but you will get potentially more expertise, given that they may have worked in that industry before, or maybe they're aligned on where the technology needs to go in order to scale. Is there anything that you could speak on to that comment in terms of when it is viable versus less viable, to maybe go with bigger names?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, bigger names are always good, and, you know, the brand can be helpful with recruiting and other things. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think it really comes down to the individual. You also, I think, need to be thinking about the next round. I mean, one of the big advantages of getting a known VC, especially if they're a certain size, is that there's a good chance they'll participate at your next round, maybe even lead it. And that can really help. We weren't able to do that this time, but that can definitely be an advantage. The other thing that I'll say that may be a little bit controversial, I work on the assumption that the VC only brings cash. Now, all of them will say, we have an incredible network, we have a whole organization to help you, we have all this insight. And some do, and some have the bandwidth, and some really make a difference. But I work on the assumption that either they don't have the capabilities, they don't have the bandwidth, you know, I just assume it's cash to start with. And if I get more than that, that's absolutely a bonus. But at the end of the day, I believe an entrepreneur, a founder, cannot assume they're going to get all of this help. At the end of the day, it's your company. You've got to go and do the hard work. And don't assume just because you join a big firm and they've got 100 people in their organization to help you that all of that's going to get done. It might, in which case, great, but don't assume it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, this may be a bit of a personal question, but what has been the toughest moment or the darkest moment with Impossible and then the best win so far? Because you're still very early in the journey.
Yeah, we're still very early. I mean, I think we haven't had massive amount of tough times, you know, so I would say nothing that bad. I mean, some key advisors got too busy and weren't able to give us some bandwidth that we were hoping to have. But you know, no dark times. Now, my last company, you know, we got to, I think, 2 days not before we would not be able to make payroll. And as a CEO, when you've got, you know, a team of 20 or more people relying on getting paid, that's tough. Touch wood, we won't get there at this company, but that's pretty dark. And I also had dark times where, you know, you're negotiating to do another round of funding. This was with a strategic. And you've been negotiating for a year, you're almost at the final stage, and that senior executive leaves the company.
Yeah.
And now the sponsor's gone and you don't know what's going to happen. That also happened. That was a pretty, pretty dark day. Fortunately, another executive took over and and allowed the deal to happen. But on the good side, I think definitely closing the last round. I mean, we announced a $10 million funding, and you know that's a lot of cash. Obviously, hardware needs a bit more than SaaS, but it gives us a good amount of runway now to get these robots built and to show them off to the world.
If you could speak to kind of the mechanics of the round a little bit without giving away the secrets, that would be amazing too.
Yeah. Again, I would say this round came together all because of YC, to be frank. YC, and I would encourage any of your audience to at least apply. It's not super easy to get in. I think they only take a few percent, but if you do, it gives you an incredible platform. You know, you get massive exposure. And so of the round, just under half came from small checks from angel investors and syndicate groups between 50K and 300K. And, you know, the YC has this demo day. And then for the month after YC, you're just back-to-back meetings and people give you money with safes, which makes it very easy. And then, just over half came from an individual investor who, again, was heavily connected with the YC community that just really loved the story.
That's awesome. Okay. Well, speaking of YC, there was a quote I sent over to you by Sam Altman. And I believe it was in I can't remember the university, but regardless, this is what the quote said. And it really made me rethink about who can potentially start a company. Because to your point, it is so hard, you know, having a great support system, friends, family, you know, maybe a wife or a husband or a partner, that stuff matters. But what do you think? I want your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm kind of lower middle class. My family were, not poor, but not massively well off. I grew up in the UK. What I would say is when I grew up, when I went to school, I didn't even know the word entrepreneur. You know, there weren't the role models in the UK, I went to high school in late 80s. So I'm a bit older than probably your audience here, but I had no idea. And I wish I had known, because for me now, looking back, it's obvious. This is what I am. It's what I like to do.
Right.
But there weren't even the role models. I didn't really understand it. And the whole concept of creating a company wasn't even talked about in the UK at the time, and so that's all changed. And, I think anyone can create a company right now. The barriers are really quite low, but I'm not saying everyone should. I think there's a lot of great experience that you can gain working at a startup. And I would almost encourage that might be a first step before going and starting one from scratch. Of course, you need a good idea, you need a good team, a good market. But I would encourage your audience to go and work at a startup. I was lucky early in my career. I ended up working at this, when I joined it, 60-person startup called Arm. And that went on to have a pretty successful IPO and then was bought by SoftBank for $32 billion. So it became a very successful startup. But if you join a successful growing startup, the amount of opportunities that you get as a young person is incredible. There's so much to be done. You just take on responsibility that you would never be given in a large organization at the level that you're at. And for me, it was phenomenal. And so that's probably what my advice would be: to join a startup, ideally one you really believe in. I strongly believe in climate tech. I think we got a lot of problems to solve around the climate. And I think entrepreneurs and startups can solve many of those. and try and find one that's going to have a high growth, because you're going to learn so much. Do that for, say, 5 years or so. And then once you've got a bit more of the experience, then consider. Because starting a company on your own is very challenging. I think you always want a team. I mean, with Impossible Mining, I took about a year from the idea to really find my co-founders. Because to me, it was no point really going on my own. I needed someone like Jason, who's an expert in building underwater robots, and Renee, who's, you know, she's an expert in seabed mining and regulations and working with stakeholders. So, you know, finding your team takes time. And if you're at a startup, that may be a great place to find the team.
You mentioned try and find a high growth company. Again, given that my audience is a bit younger, you know, they're just breaking into the career space, into what will be hopefully a very long journey. Yeah. Are there some do's and don'ts? Are there some red flags and green flags to look for?
I don't think you have to find a high growth, and I don't think you have to find a startup. I think if you go to one of the bigger tech companies, you're still going to learn a lot and build a big network. So for I sure. wouldn't say you have to do that. I would look for a company that you associate with your values. You know, is it doing the right things? I think, you know, we spend so much time at work. I think, you know, in my age, work was, you did it, you got paid. But I think now you should really do work at a place where you believe in that company, you believe in its values. Right. And again, that's why I come back to climate tech. If you could do something that's really going to be good for the planet as well, and get paid and get a bunch of experiences and knowledge and network, that's a win all around.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let me ask you one final question. Again, a bit more of a personal one, but what is Oliver passionate about that he doesn't get asked about a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I love building something from nothing and seeing it develop. And I think that's what all entrepreneurs fundamentally have. So, you know, Impossible Mining is kind of my baby because I had the idea.
Yeah.
But and so seeing it come from this tiny gem of an idea to now have these incredible co-founders that are working with me to now raise decent amount of money and building something. And you know, I think we're just getting going. I just feel so optimistic of what we can do. And so, you know, really passionate about that. On a purely personal level, I love history. I mean, I'm a big, you know, when I have spare time, I'm listening to history podcasts and all sorts of different things. And I just think the world is so fascinating, and just learning absolutely. About different civilizations and what they did in different time periods. I mean, to me, it boggles the mind to think 2,000 years ago, you know, Rome had running water, you know, they had plumbing, you know, it's just fascinating. They built aqueducts to move water, you know, tens of miles to get to where it needed to be, crossing valleys. Spectacular. Right. And many of them still exist.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a favorite podcast? I've watched Hardcore History a little bit, but what are your top three?
Hardcore History is definitely up there. It's probably the one I listen to the most. There's the History Show. It's a UK magazine that I cover a bit. But Hardcore History is well above all the others. And they have an addendum version as well. So there's kind of two in there.
That's amazing. Okay. Well, we're at time. I will leave it there. But Oliver, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much as well.